Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, episode 206. This episode is brought to you by the book Frank Herbert The Works, written by Bob Bogle and published by Hotspur Publishing.
It's basically about the business of writing, and they tell you the stuff they wish that someone had told them when they got started as writers.
You know, somebody can be a successful marketer and not necessarily provide a quality product.
I'm going to let Moses go because he's frothing at the mouth to talk about this one.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. So that seems like a pretty good career choice.
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto.
Oh, you sound terrible. What happened? I'm just kidding.
Oh, man.
And now, podstructed on a zeppelin by an apprentice mage and delivered by a rocket ship to a benevolent dragon, Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
This is Brent Bowen with an interview I conducted at the 2012 Worldcon in Chicago.
I'm so pleased to welcome our next guest, awesome Austinite and finalist for this year's John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer. Her debut novel, A Blood and Honey, one of my top books from 2011, folks, was published by Nightshade Books in 2011. Did I mention 2011 twice? I did, didn't I? And her sequel, In Blue Skies from Pain, came out in March of this year. Stina Light, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So, if our listeners haven't checked out our interview from episode 114, shame on them, really, and I mean it, really, we'll go ahead and oblige them and tell them about the Fae and the Fallen books, but particularly, what do you have in store for readers with And Blue Skies from Pain?
So, yeah, so basically, it's set in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. Liam, the main character, is... He's a Northern Irish Catholic who thinks his father was a Protestant who ran on his mom when she became pregnant. That's what he thinks, and it turns out that his father's actually Bran, a shapeshifter, a Pooka. And so Liam, who is half Pooka and doesn't know it, he becomes a driver for an IRA bank robbing unit, and then everything goes horribly awry. That's book one. Book two is more about his trying to piece his life back together and learning more about himself and what it means to be a Pooka. And I happen to like punk music quite a bit, and the punk scene in Belfast was quite a bit different than the punk scene in Northern Ireland, in London, actually. So, the whole thing just kind of fascinates me. And in London, the punk scene was more focused on anarchy and chaos and like breaking up a very established, like, ossified system. Mm-hmm. In Belfast, it was very different. They had all the chaos that anyone could possibly stand. So basically, the way things were is they didn't care which side of the divide you came from. If you were there to listen to the music and get drunk, hang out, get messed up, listen to music, you were fine. They didn't care which side you came from, and they made a point of it. So it actually had quite a bit more in common with the 60s hippies movement here in the United States. The interesting thing about it is the punk movement in London lasted about 9 months or so. In Belfast, it lasted from 1976 till 1981. Yeah, so it was quite a bit different scene.
And the punk scenes, the backdrop, because this is what you promised me last time we talked, is that this was going to be the backdrop of book two.
It's definitely in there. It doesn't make as big an appearance as I was hoping that it would. funny, but it's definitely in there because I definitely wanted to emphasize that part of the scene.
And how did you decide to incorporate, other than it being cool? I mean, and historically significant in a lot of ways, and the differences between it and the London scene. How did you decide it was right to incorporate into the book, and particularly with Liam? How's it fit with Liam?
Well, Liam is, he's a huge Clash fan. He loves the Clash. And I've always seen him as a bit punk, and I've always felt like that was totally his scene. If he had had a different life where he hadn't been involved in the IRA or any of that stuff, then he would have totally been just into the punk scene. That would have been his thing. He likes music a great deal. That's how I see him. He would be very into it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I would imagine he would be very into it, considering what you had mentioned to book one about things going grossly awry. And one of the things that, I don't want to give too much away, but he gets married in book one.
Right.
Right. And right. There's travesty where he marries character Mary Kate. So in book two, how much is he holding on to Mary Kate's memory? Spoiler, folks, sorry, but how much is he holding on to her memory? Okay. You should have already read book one.
So, like, on a scale of 1 to 10, I would say 11. He's very much hanging on to her memory quite a bit and blaming himself for things that happened to her, regardless of it being partially her fault, too. But yeah, he's very much hanging on to her. I totally gave him that aspect of my personality that doesn't like to say goodbye.
doesn't like to let go.
Oh, absolutely. Doesn't like to let go. I mean, she was basically when you think about it, she was really that shining moment for him, and she's gone. So he would be very attached to her memory.
You know, it's interesting, this being a book too. You know, one of the things I haven't asked you is whether you're planning to commit trilogy or beyond with this. Or
oh,
this
absolutely. Is I really okay. want to, yes.
Okay. And so one of the things, you know, when I spoke with Blake Charlton a couple of years ago, and we were talking about the situation a writer gets in where they work, you know, years and years and years on book one, and it's they're able to mold it to perfection and get it just the way they like it, and then it's released out into the world, their little baby's released out into the world, and then you get to book two and you've got all these business pressures and it needs to be done and done now. How did you deal with what he kind of coined book two syndrome in that regard?
Well, I just pushed through. I mean, book two is very hard. It's very, very hard, especially if book one actually takes off in any way, shape, or form. And so you go through this whole thing where you're like, is this going to be as good as book one? Will I ever write as well as book one? Will I ever do as well as ever again? I mean, am I going to be able to hold up to that? And so that's all going on through your head. And on top of everything else, I'm an organic writer, so I don't like writing with outlines.
Oh, your pants are not a plot.
Yeah. And so in book two, my agent made me write a very thorough, specific outline for book two. And so I had to spend months trying really hard to forget what I had written for that outline, because my subconscious was like, okay, it's done. It's written already. And I'm like, no, it's not. And so
this was for Joe. This is for me.
Yes, that's for Joe. This is for me. This is what Joe needed so he could sell book two. So book two was really hard. It was really, really hard. I'm not going to kid you on that one. But at the same time, there was a lot of joy in it too, because I really love writing about Liam and Father Murray and that whole scene, that whole thing. It was a lot of fun. And I was so excited about writing another car chase scene. I called up Joe and I was like, please, please, can I write another car chase scene? And he was like, why are you asking me?
Go for it, sister.
Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah. So I was like really thrilled when the word came back from Nightshade. They were like, oh man, the car chase scene is even better in this one than this one. The first
very
one.
Sweet. Very, very nice. Now, are you taking a break? Have you gone through the same paces for book three? Or are you taking a break for a while?
I'm taking a break for just a little bit because I wanted to write something completely different for a little while. There was a lot of pressure to get everything just right as far as the historic background on it. So I just wanted to let that go for a little bit and take a break because there was so much stress involved in that. And part of it is that when you're writing about a culture that you haven't visited and you don't have a connection with, you have to be very, very careful.
Mm-hmm.
And I have always intended, I have a great deal of respect for Irish culture, for Irish people. I never intended anyone to think that I just kind of off the cuff decided to just do this for, you know, grins and not take it seriously. I don't approach things that way. I never intended it to be that way. So there was a great deal of pressure. And so I wanted to just step back a little bit and take a breather and just do something that didn't have that pressure. And then I discovered that that means that there's a whole another set of different pressures involved in that, in making up absolutely everything, because you have to make up absolutely everything. So, yeah, Joe had a nice laugh at me. But there you are.
Well, so this new line you're drawing,
yeah,
and extending, tell us a little bit about it. Since you're taking, I know you're not really taking a break, you're working.
Yeah.
So what are you working on? You're extending this other line, set of tracks here.
Yeah. So I have a totally different series, and that's going to be the first book is called the work in progress. It's called Cold Iron. It's set in the late 1700s kind of world technology. It's my own personal little setting, and me being me, I can't help stealing things from history because I love history so much. But it's not regular Earth. It's totally different, and it has all the standard races involved and like standard fantasy races. But of course, they don't call themselves those things, and I've applied my own twist to them, like I generally tend to, and yeah.
And a magic system. You were telling me about a wicked magic system, I think, that's going along with this
yeah.
story, too.
Yeah, yeah. The culture... In the first book, it centers around Elador, which is basically... We might as well just call them elves. And their whole society is very hopped up. They're very, very into magic. Anybody who has magic is a person, and anyone who doesn't have magic is not. So... I have three main characters. There's Nels and his twin sister, Suvi. And Nels does not have magic, and Suvi does. She ended up with all of the magic. So he has to fake it. And if you don't have magic, and I did mention that, if you don't mm-hmm. have magic, you're nothing. So he ends up becoming a soldier. He loses the kingdom. He doesn't become... He's no longer considered... royalty, and he becomes a soldier, and soldiers are very bottom rung in this society because they have to do with death, and death is a subject they totally avoid at all costs. Yeah, so I've got this long rambly story about that, and I don't have my elevator pitch in mind, obviously.
Still sounds amazing. Yeah, no, we'll look forward to when the struggle we were talking about is whether originally you'd planned on that being a young adult series, and we'll have to see.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. We'll see if that comes out being, you know, I'm trying to keep things younger.
Your versions of war tend to drive things out of young adult.
Tend to, yeah. Well, I don't believe in prettying it up. I just don't. I don't... I don't believe it should be, honestly. I mean, and these are, if you're 18, 19 years old and you're serving in the armed services, I mean, this is stuff you end up dealing with. I mean, and I feel prettying it up is a disservice. So.
Very fair. Very fair.
Attention all Frank Herbert fans. Frank Herbert, The Works by Bob Bogle is a comprehensive critical biography documenting the literary achievements and sometimes stupendous disappointments which comprise the legacy of this colossal figure, Frank Herbert, who has so long dominated the science fiction stage. Herbert's most famous and compelling works, including some of the Dune novels, Whipping Star, Destination Void, and The Saratoga Barrier, are recasts in an original compositional and intellectual perspective that establishes the hidden interrelationships and ideological connectivity of Frank's work. A new understanding of the deeper significance which riddles his most well-known works emerges from the context of his less renowned fiction and nonfiction alike, as well as from consideration of the times and places in which he worked. So to learn more about Frank Herbert, The Works, visit adventuresinscifipublishing.com and click on the image for Frank Herbert, The Works by Bob Bogle, published by Hotspur Publishing.
Speaking of things that aren't, questions that aren't fair, but I'm going to ask them anyway.
Because you're evil that way.
Yes, I am evil that way. Now, before your debut novel, I was looking at all the online bio stuff, and it shows one professional publication credit, a flash fiction piece in the Vandermeer surreal anthology Last Drink, Birdhead. So, first, where the heck do you come from? Okay, so you have one flash fiction piece, and then I'm sitting across from Campbell nominees. So one flash fiction piece, Campbell nominee. Who else's career path looks like that? Have you gone out and done any research?
No, I really haven't. Honestly, I would be amazed if anybody else's looks like that. I can't even explain to you how that happened, really. I mean, honestly, when...
Strictest definition, I think they should give you the award hands down for best new writer. Like, just off the tree.
Well, thank you. But... yeah, it is a little weird, I have to say. But I tried very hard for a very long time to get a short story published, and it just wasn't happening. And then one day, Jeff Vandermeer, who... I was involved in Turkey City, and I met Jeff Vandermeer through Turkey City. They had invited him to come to the workshop one day. And he was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And we talked a lot. We exchanged a few emails afterwards, and I learned a great deal from him in a very short period of time because he's a wonderful teacher. And so one day he just contacts me on Facebook and is like, Last Drink, Birdhead, number one rule about Last Drink, Birdhead, one does not speak of Last Drink, Birdhead.
Okay.
So I was like, okay. 500 words, Last Drink, Birdhead. I was like, okay, fine. So I had been thinking for quite a while about a story wherein Jonesy from Alien is the bad guy. And I was like, I really wanted to play with that idea. And I was like, oh, Birdhead, Jonesy, I got it, So I wrote a story about, how that scene in Aliens, mm-hmm. they have like the little drinky birds, right?
Right.
Right? Yeah. So that's what I wrote about.
Okay.
And Jonesy is the bad guy. So that's how that ended up being. And another aspect of that story is like that whole, how each of us are just like the center of our universe. We want to be the hero of our story. So the main character in that story, she's got this ridiculous idea that, because of the motion of her drinking motion, that she's somehow ordering the energy in the air, the molecules in the air, to make sure that the ship doesn't explode for whatever reason. I mean, that's what she believes. And that the crew's lives depend upon her continuing to this motion. But that's what that story is all about, really. And I don't know, it also has a literary reference in there, too. But I had a great time with that story, and he really loved it, so he took it. And so that was my very first actual publishing credit.
And you know, I'm just in part teasing you, right? Because
I know.
I know that there are a lot of any person that writes and then achieves the success that you have just in a short period of time has gone through and seen a number of successes, even if they're not widely known and recognized from a publication credit, right?
Right.
Because you and I had even talked about the Charles DeLint, you know, like the conversations you had with Charles DeLint.
Right.
So what milestones, you know, leading up to A Blood and Honey, what, and outside of the anthology credit, what milestones and pitfalls kind of got you to today?
Well, I'm a big believer in workshops, and I participated in the ArmadilloCon Writers Workshop. And the second time that I participated, I had a short story, and that ended up in the editor's group. And Jim Minns liked it a great deal and asked me for my manuscript, and which is like the first time that it had ever happened and it hasn't happened since. But at that point, of course, that was like a big high. And then he proceeded not to buy it because it wasn't good enough, because I wasn't ready yet. Really wasn't ready yet. And actually, that was a really valuable lesson. But during the process of that whole year where I was preparing that novel to send to Jim Minns, I was also talking to Joshua Williams.
Yeah.
And he was like the first agent that I've actually had a real conversation with.
Sure.
About story and what it takes to write a good story. And he gave me some really great advice, and he was really wonderful. But at the end of that year, he said, "You're just not ready yet." And I wasn't. And it was hard. It was really hard to go from that high and then boom, you're not ready yet. Mm-hmm. And
we see the talent. We give you just a taste, but you're going to have to keep working.
Exactly. Yeah. So I hit that wall, and Sharon Shin and my best friend, Melissa Tyler, they both were like elbowing me in the ribs going, "Okay, when are you going to write something else? When are you going to write something different?" And one of the things that Melissa and I used to do pretty constantly, not constantly, but pretty regularly, so we would do writing exercises.
Kind of prompts or exercises. Yeah.
Prompts. And so I ended up writing this scene that ended up being the scene where Liam is tossed out of the house for sleeping with Mary Kate. And I was like, "Oh man, I really like this character. I really want to go with this whole backstory. This is really fun." And so I went ahead with that. And in the end, I eventually ended up talking to Joe Monte through... this is so roundabout. Because I met Holly Black while I was working at a bookstore called Book People. And I met her because I sold like 100 copies of Tithe all by myself. Hard copy. And I had no idea that people were tracking these things. And her publisher sent her to Austin because that was obviously a big spike.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. And so I had ended up having dinner with her. And she was she's a wonderful person. She was lovely to me and just marvelous. And so like for 6 years on and off, she and I exchanged emails over time. And when I decided to shop Of Blood and Honey around, I decided that I would ask... I knew enough published authors by that point. I decided I would ask what their opinions were on agents. So I asked Holly for her opinion, and she was like, "So send me the first chapter, and then I'll let you know what... Because I think I have somebody in mind for you. And he's just starting out as an agent. So this would be a really good time. But, you know, and if I think it meets up, you know, measures up, then I'll let
pass
you know."
Yeah.
So she was, funny enough, she was vacationing in Ireland at the time.
If you could fact check a few things for me. Yes.
So I sent her the first chapter, and she loved it so much. She ran off to Joe and went, "Oh, whoops. I should have asked you if it was okay for me to send it to him." I was like, "Are you kidding me?" So, yeah, that's how I ended up with Joe as my agent. He read the first version of the manuscript and asked me to ditch 66,000 words of that original manuscript, and then I rewrote it, and he loved it, and that's how I ended up with that.
Excellent.
And, yeah, and he totally believes in my writing. He's just been so supportive and so wonderful. He's a marvelous agent.
Well, congratulations. You deserved it. You've deserved it. Speaking of things that are milestones, and I think in our lives, particularly as those that care about genre and care about reading and care about writing, we've lost several luminaries over the last year. Anne McCaffrey and Ray Bradbury, just to name a few. How did those? I know you and I were just chatting briefly how maybe those writers influenced your work, and or what they meant to you.
Yeah.
And mind speaking of, I know you're a fan of Anne McCaffrey in particular. So
yeah, I really like both of them actually. Anne McCaffrey was one of those writers that I hit when I was in high school, and I loved her work, so I read a great deal of it. Really liked it. And Ray Bradbury, my father read Something Wicked This Way Comes to Me when I was 12. And I just latched on to him, his work, from that point forward. And I just adore his work so much, and I always have. So for me, he's kind of like my standard, you know? He's the North Star that I shoot for.
And a thank you, Dad moment. I think we picked on your dad last interview.
Well, yeah, but you...
But you're thanking him.
You erased it. One hopes. But yeah, no,
thank you, Dad. Yeah, for introducing me to Ray Bradbury.
Ray Bradbury, yay.
Yeah, no, well, speaking of giving, and your father giving to you, now I've known you a bit since 2008, and I know you're a giving person, right? And you've coordinated the ArmadilloCon workshop for years and other things. So there's this little online deal that you're helping support.
Yeah.
What led you to help out this struggling podcaster? And he comments on our show from time to time, so he'll get a kick out of this little meta moment here. Sean Duke, you. What led you to help out a struggling podcaster, Sean Duke, in his quest for a much needed replacement laptop? I just want to know. And so Stina and I are uniquely joined in this thing. So, yes.
I love Sean. He's wonderful. I ended up interviewing for the Skiffy and Fandy show. Like, I've done it a couple of times because I just love them. They're so much fun to talk to, and it's just a blast talking to them. And they're really good people, the both of them. And I don't know. When I get to know someone, and he was just like, "Oh, I need a new laptop." And I was like, "Dude, really? Come on! I could totally, you know, what's..." Here, you can have a copy of book two to give away. And so I wanted to help out. I don't know, I just, people gave me money to be here for Worldcon, and I wouldn't be here if it weren't for that.
Yeah, and honestly, talk about that process a little bit. How, you didn't do it through Kickstarter too, you used an alternative platform.
Yeah, Indiegogo.
Indiegogo. And it ended up, and that was part of the reason why I actually ended up going and helping Sean out, because by the time I was able to get on the Indiegogo platform, you had your trip paid for.
Yeah.
And then some.
It was like within 24 hours. It was insane. I mean, honestly, I felt awful because I was just like, I don't know. I mean, this is not any altruistic thing, you know, where I'm trying to help people get a wheelchair or anything like really important, you know. It's just I would kind of like to go to Worldcon so that I can be there for the award ceremony because I'm a nominee. I was like, you know, that's kind of selfish and stuff, but you know, I was raised Catholic, so I'm guilty. So I was like, oh, I don't know, I feel so guilty for doing this. And then Christy Yant was like, oh, please, you really have to do this. Please, let me give you money. Just please, let me give you money. And I was like, all right, fine. Okay.
People would have sent it in envelopes anyway, even if you had no...
So, apparently, and I had no idea, seriously, I had no idea. I was like, okay, so I need to make sure that this is plenty of time to make the money, you know, for the trip. And like, within less than 24 hours, it had made the money. I was just like, wow. I mean, it just totally... blew me away.
What's a once-in-a-lifetime moment?
Well, that's true, and I really deeply appreciate it. Oh, my God, I deeply appreciate it. And then I promptly got sick and everything else right after that, so I feel really bad because I was able to, like, get the all the bookmarks off to the people who had the bookmarks perk, but I haven't gotten the books out, the actual physical books out to people yet, and I feel awful, but I've been sick, I had a broken arm, just one thing after another, it's been awful.
You shouldn't feel horrible. To help alleviate your guilt, it's a stat we've used on the podcast a few times where Neil Gaiman was talking about a study that they looked at writers, so I don't know if it was isolated specifically to genre, but it was fiction writers, and 6% of them make a living wage.
Wow.
So, to ask fans for help, I don't think so. You should worry about that. You should.
Well, thank you again, and thank you.
And it was all worth it when you were named a finalist for this year's John W. Campbell Award. And what's it going to mean? I mean, seriously, what's it going to mean to you?
It means so much. What would it mean to anybody? I mean, it's just incredible. Being nominated alone is just mind-bending all by itself, because again, like I said, you know, here I have, like, you know, this little flash fiction piece and then two novels. I mean, where did that come from? Exactly. So just as whiplashy as that feels for you, it feels like 50 times worse for me, because it's like I can't even believe that this has happened. And sometimes I wake up and I'm like, oh, that's some other Stina that they're talking about, and then some mornings I wake up and I'm like, yep, that's me. Isn't that cool?
Well, it couldn't have happened to a nicer person. Aww, so you should know. You should know that.
Thank
now,
you.
So for folks that want to tap into that nicest, where can they do that? I know you're on Twitter and Facebook, and
yep,
you're out there. Where throw out the handles.
Okay, I'm so hard to find on Facebook. It's Stina Light. Ta-da! And so hard to find on Twitter, Stina Light.
There you go. And you do a little blog. You've got a site out there,
yes,
as well.
Yes, I do. It's cslight.com, LEICHT.
Do a little blogging.
Yep, that's
awesome.
My blog.
Awesome. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to mention that I may have missed?
I think
you think I covered it all.
And Blue Skies, we talked about it in Blue Skies from Pain. I think we talked about everything.
Well, Stina, as always, it's an absolute joy to sit down and have a conversation with you, whether microphones in front of us or not.
The little spidery,
so the little spidery thing.
With the giant black nose and the red eyes.
I appreciate you taking the time, considering you were still waiting on your luggage, too.
Yeah, my luggage hasn't shown up yet, still.
So
I think it's revenge for not mailing out those books yet.
No more guilt, Catholic girl.
Oh, All right,
Stina.
All right, thank you.
Visit Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing for show notes, links, reviews, special guests, videos, and more. Email us at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com. Sound effects from the Free Sounds Project. Music by Asymmetry, found at musically.com. No authors were seriously damaged in the making of this podcast.